Well, you knew I had to play that song for tonight's discussion. John Lennon, Imagine, his biggest solo hit. Biggest hit as a solo artist, that is, from 1971. And here's a spiritual guy who spent much of his adult life pursuing spiritual sorts of topics and pursuits and did not care for organized religion at all, as you can tell from the lyrics of that song. And we'll ask to my guest, Jeff Kripal, about that a little bit, as well as his take on a couple of spiritual topics. So whether or not we can get him to tell us if he believes that something in us goes on that is not connected just to the physical body and the brain, but that's something that lives independently of those and might live on, as many religions, most religions believe. We'll get to that and get to your questions as well right after this on Coast to Coast. Jeff, I began the program three hours ago, with this quote that is from your book, and the quote goes like this: "We are not human beings having spiritual experiences. We are spiritual beings having human experiences." And I'll tell you, that hit me like a ton of bricks, because it's just a feeling that I think I've always had, but have never been able to express in such an eloquent way. I wonder if you could give us your take on that.
Yeah, so that's a quote from Teilhard de Chardin, the French Catholic priest and evolutionary biologist, and that's the basic topic of Chapter 12, the last chapter in the book, where I set out, you know, what it is I think about all of this, and the basic idea is this: that you can, in fact, reduce all religious experience and expression to human nature, but it turns out that human nature isn't what we thought it is, and it appears to have some kind of transcendent or divine nature to it. And so that's what I call a reflexive rereading of religion. You reduce things to the human being, but it turns out the human being may in fact be divine or contain some kind of divine element. So that happens to be my own position as well.
Well, that was my next question. I didn't know if I was going to be able to get that out of you. But, I mean, you can't take a stand on any particular religion. You have to be able to be the neutral arbiter on these things in your line of work. But I wonder if you're encouraged by all the different faiths and experiences that you've studied that convince that there is something in us that exists separate from our body or brain, more than just electrical stimulation or neurons firing or whatever.
Right. Well, yeah, no, I am heartened. I don't accept the productive model of consciousness. I think the filter thesis is the way to go. The filter thesis leaves a lot of room open for us surviving in some form of bodily death. I mean, if the productive model is correct and consciousness is a product of brain, when the brain shuts down, of course consciousness goes away, like turning off a light switch. But if consciousness exists outside the body and brain and is filtered through it, then when the brain and body die, consciousness is unaffected. It just goes on. And that's my own position. I ask students all the time to tell me what they think. And so they, of course, often ask me what I think, and I think it's only fair I tell them. But I don't want to impose what I think on all of the materials and all of the different religious positions. That's where, you know, that's my job, to be neutral, as you said. But at some point, you know, you do need to take a position. I'm a human being, too. I'm part of the human community, and I think that's only fair. So in terms of the religions, you know, I'm both heartened and not heartened. I mean, my position is that one of the problems with religion in the world is that religious people privilege their religious identities over their humanity. In other words, they think they're a Christian or a Muslim or a Hindu or a Buddhist before they're a human being. And I think we need to flip that. I think we need to affirm our humanity over our particular ethnic and religious identities, which are built on that humanity. You know, every human being born into this world, none of them are Christians or Jews or Muslims or Buddhists or anything else. They're human beings, and then we build those religious identities on top of that through childbearing and culture and language and ritual. And so my position is we just need to flip our priorities. We can still be all those things, but we need to see them as secondary to our shared human nature.
You make the point in the book, too, you say about consciousness, that it is the ground of all science. It's not just a matter that folks in your particular niche are going to study. It's the ground of all science, in a sense. I suppose that a lot of folks who call themselves scientists would disagree with that.
Well, I don't see how they could disagree with that. They can only do science because they're conscious.
Yeah.
And every scientific experiment is a conscious being, manipulating the material world. And every mathematical equation, it was produced by some form of consciousness we call a human person. So there is no science without consciousness. Science is a product of human consciousness, clearly.
You know, we talked about a variety of different kinds of events, supernatural, weird UFO type things, and how they are viewed through the prism of different religious beliefs. But I guess you could look at it the flip side, too. I'd imagine that some of these things, UFO-type events, sort of affected the development of some of these beliefs way back when, just in the same way they would create a new UFO cult now, Heaven's Gate or whatever, that they would have had effects back at the beginning of some of these faiths.
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, the gods have been coming from the sky to mess with human beings for as far back as we can see. And of course, you know, the ancient world didn't call them UFOs or flying saucers. They called them the gods. That language is ours. It came out of the Cold War and science fiction. But yeah, I think there's a very clear line from the ancient world to the modern phenomenon. I just don't want to privilege our own modern reading of that. That's all.
One other question, then I'll go to the phones. You know, the Vatican has sort of been nibbling around the edges about the ET topic for a while. They keep coming out with pronouncements that edge closer and closer to something really dramatic, but they're saying, hey, we're fine with it. We have no problem believing it. It's sort of like it's more souls to save. They have the Vatican astronomy. They keep hinting that there's more to come. And have you thought about what an announcement from the Vatican might be? How it might affect the world, change the world beyond just Catholics?
Well, you know, I grew up Catholic and was trained by Catholics and very indebted to that tradition. I actually don't agree. I mean, if that's the Vatican position on things, I'm at odds with it. There are folks in my world, in the study of religion, Ted Peters comes to mind, came out with a book called UFOs, God's Chariot. And folks like Peters want to argue that there's really nothing incompatible about the UFO phenomena and religious faith. And, you know, I happen to think there is. I think if, you know, we suddenly had evidence of extraterrestrial life or some kind of UFO lands on the White House lawn, I think it would dramatically alter the religious tradition. I think it would be a deep, deep, deep challenge to them. And I don't see any reason why, like take the Catholic situation, I don't see any reason why, if you want to believe Christ died for our sins, why that would apply to someone from another planet or galaxy or star system.
Well, also, if the announcement wasn't that they came from other planets, if it was something more exotic, the kind of things that you have talked about with Jacques Vallée, I mean, it might upset the whole religious apple cart in ways
that they can't even anticipate. Yeah, I actually think it does upset the whole religious apple cart. I simply don't see how it couldn't. I think it's a much more radical phenomenon than the Vatican suggesting. Ted Peters is suggesting.
Let's take a couple of calls. Blair in Sedona, Arizona on the wild card line. Hi, Blair. You're on with Jeff Kripal.
Hi, Jeff and George. George, my Paul McCartney experience was 1976 at the Cow Palace, Wings Over America tour.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've got some recordings of that. Yep.
For sure. And Mr. Kripal, I have an astronomer friend who's next door to you at Texas A&M, Professor Kevin Crucionis. And he's a we've been having these discussions for 40 years. If you drop him a line and says, Blair says, hi, I'd like to have you on my side on our debate on whether the body and the soul have a spiritual counterpart.
Okay. I don't know him, but okay.
Yeah, Baba Ram Dass said the sacrifice of Christ wasn't the crucifixion, was leaving the Father in the first place to come forth as the Son. So here's another comparison you might think about. And there is some talk of this is a classroom, and Revelations 10:11, it says you must prophesize again about many peoples, nations, languages. So it sounds like a case of, wouldn't you say, God provides and humanity divides?
Well, unfortunately, no. I mean, God divides too. I mean, there's God, as we imagine, have imagined God in these different religions, is clearly a divisive element in human culture and human civilization. Now, I don't think that's really God. I think that's human beings imagining God being divisive. But unfortunately, the scripture and the whole idea of God has divided human beings as much as it's united them in human history.
Yeah, I mean, look at the Middle East. It's sort of like we're right, you're wrong. Our beliefs are right, and you're completely wrong. And
well, we'll
fight
you. Yeah, like the scripture that Blair just quoted, the Book of Revelation, is an extremely violent book of the Bible in which pretty much everybody who's not on the right side gets killed at the end. So I don't see those things as very hopeful. That's the kind of thing I'm trying to write against in the textbook.
Thanks, Blair. Appreciate it. And we should I should mention that Ram Dass is mentioned in your book. He's sort of an example of a guy who, an intellectual who took a completely different path after having spiritual awakening and experiences.
Right. And, you know, the Beatles appear too, right? I mean, I make this argument that the comparative study of religion really came into its own after the counterculture and because of the influx of Asian religious ideas into American culture in the 60s and 70s.
Well, I appreciate the connection there. It makes all my pro-Beatle comments somewhat relevant to tonight's discussion.
Well, I it is a little bragging point. I bet it's the only textbook you've ever seen that has a Beatles cover in it.
That's absolutely true. I would take this class. I would take it in a second. Joel in St. Louis on the wild card line. Hi, Joel. Good morning. You're on with Jeff and George.
Hi, good morning. George, I just wanted to comment. Well, I have two comments, one for you, one for him. I totally don't believe that Uri Geller is a fake. He's for real.
I
had an experience where he fixed my wristwatch over the television back in the early 80s. My watch was broken, had a broken spring, and it continued working for like 6 months after he fixed it.
Well, Joel, we had that same experiment here on the air on Coast to Coast, and hundreds of listeners wrote in and said he did the same thing via the radio airwaves, however that works.
Yeah, and then after about six months, it stopped working again, and I told my father about it, who my father is a big believer in everything is energy and the mind is powerful, and he was able to duplicate Uri Geller's work and got my watch to work again for like another 3 months.
Way to go, Dad.
Yeah, but my comment, too, was the whole religion thing. I've switched religions so many times in my life to where I finally realized that, and I would like to take a class also, and I want to find your book and purchase that textbook, that people should not go seeking religions outside of themselves, but should look for, we're all spiritual beings, and I think it comes from inside. And I've come to the conclusion that with 7.5 billion people on this planet, there's 7.5 billion correct spiritual paths. There is not one true religion. Whatever a person believes that makes them happy, that connects them with God, Source, Allah, whatever, Yahweh, whatever they want to call what they worship or follow or not worship, even if it's flying spaghetti monster, that is the right religion for them, as long as it makes them a better person and connects them better with their neighbor and helps them contribute to making this world better. And I studied religion, and And I think it's different for everybody.
Well, I know that reference to the flying spaghetti monster. I guess maybe we can characterize it as whatever floats your boat, as long as it doesn't hurt somebody else. Jeff, your take on it?
Well, yeah. So that's a comparative practice that she just articulated so well. And that's what, you know, it's usually framed as being spiritual but not religious. And it's a very common comparative strategy these days. And again, I discussed that in the book. It actually goes back to, believe it or not, Walt Whitman in the middle of the 19th century. But it's very prominent now, particularly among younger people. So absolutely. I mean, I think that's kind of a version of what I was trying to articulate earlier, that we, you know, we affirm our humanity over our religious identity.
Thank you, Joelle, for the call. Yeah, the no religion religion, is that the phrase you use? And I think it could sort of relates to what John Lennon was talking about and Imagine. You know, he's a spiritual guy, but not for organized religion.
Right. Lennon was definitely in that spiritual but not religious camp. Absolutely.
Did you say it's the fastest growing sort of religious segment?
It's the dominant demographic among people under the age of 30 in this country now. So it's a very prominent position these days. It's not dominant once you get over 30, because people tend to have children and families and they want some more stable kind of religious community. But it tends to be very dominant in among younger people. But you can find it at any age group as well.
We have people hanging on the phones, but I don't want to cut somebody off. I have a quick one I want to get in before we go to the break. It's you mentioned at the end in this pivotal chapter 12 about, and you used the example of the Matrix, about glitches in the Matrix. Deja vu was the example of the movie, but the idea, you explain the idea, what you mean by that.
Well, I think paranormal events, particularly synchronicities, are essentially glitches in the Matrix. And I think we're all living in the Matrix, and by that I don't mean a computer program. I mean a culture. All of us are born into cultures. We're born into stories that we didn't write and that we may not even like, and that part of the comparative study of religion is realizing that fact and kind of waking up out of that story if you so choose.
The idea of a simulated reality, if not computer-generated,
But it's generated by language and by culture. You know, language is what generates our simulated reality. And we're born into those languages. We don't choose them. And we learn them as infants and small children. And we just assume that the languages we speak accurately reflect the world as it is. But in fact, they're creating the world as a kind of simulation.
Then in that model, you can change it. You really can change it.
That's right. That's the power of the model, and that's the power of the comparative study of religion. People, when people hear me say that, they're like, "Oh my God, that's horrible!" And my response is, "No, it's great because it means we can change it. We can rewrite it. We can rewrite the world."
I should tell people again, the book is called Comparing Religions, and I don't want to scare you. I should never even have said it's a textbook because it doesn't read like a textbook. It's not anything like any textbook you've ever had. It's a heck of a lot of fun. I found that every single page had some really thought-provoking stuff. I read it in a hurry getting prepared for this interview, Jeff, I have to admit, but I'm going to go back and take my time with it because it's good stuff.
Good. I wrote it for everyone, and my goal was, this is, if you want one book you can pick up to answer almost any question about religion, this is your one stop.
All right. Well, we'll come back with more questions and calls and comments. REM takes us into the break with an appropriate tune. Billy Joe Shaver wrote that song, a pretty song called Live Forever, made famous by the artist you just heard there, the Highwaymen, four singer-songwriters who probably are pretty popular down around Rice University in that general environment. It's an uplifting take on the spiritual possibilities, the hope that most people have, the hope that we are, in fact, eternal in some form or another. When we come back, we have our final segment with my guest, Jeff Kripal, talking about his book, Comparing Religions, and we get to as many of your questions as we can. Stick around. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Guest in the final segment, Jeff Kripal, author of the new book, Comparing Religions. And as I told you a couple of times during the course of the evening, it is it's very thought-provoking, good stuff. Going back to the phone lines, first-time caller Anthony in Kansas City. You're on with Jeff and George. Hi, Anthony.
How's it doing?
All right.
So you were talking earlier about consciousness. Now, I'm very into music and different things, and you also said something about transcendence earlier. Like, if you were to play a certain frequency, like 392 hertz, to be exact, that's a G, and it correlates with Aries. So these people, they play this music that sounds kind of like...
Hello?
Yeah. It sounds kind of like wong, 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 wong. But I got a question for you. So do you believe that we're telepathically connected or anything like that?
So, Anthony, are you asking
like
me?
This book that I'm reading now is Golden Dawn.
Well,
I tell you what, Anthony, we're going to we'll let Jeff tackle what you've done before. It sounded like the first, he was talking about a sound making with a musical instrument. It was almost like a mantra or something. And
Right. Yeah, I just say a couple of things. I mean, music's a really interesting question here because, of course, music's been used for thousands of years by religious traditions to alter consciousness, and it clearly can. So, yeah, absolutely. And in terms of the telepathy question, I mean, one of the models there, which was Twain's model, is that we're all connected telepathically, but largely on an unconscious level. These things only kind of pop into consciousness in rare moments.
Anthony, thanks for the call. Welcome to the program. West of the Rockies, Tom in Santa Rosa. Hi, Tom. You're on with Jeff.
Well, thank you, George. Jeff, thank you for coming forward with this information. I really wanted to ask you about what I consider to be the hidden spirituality movement that's hidden in plain view, and it's millions of people all over the world. It all started with the anonymous 12-step programs of AA, and now Narcotics Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, like you name it, Love and Sex Addicts Anonymous. They're all based on the same 12 steps from Alcoholics Anonymous, which took it from the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount. And I won't say which one I belong to because that would be very anonymous, but I've been to meetings with a Muslim to the right of me, a Christian to the left, a Buddhist in front of me, an atheist behind me, and afterwards we all got together, held hands, and said a prayer.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. Do you have any thoughts on the ritual, the 12-step process, Jeff, and where it fits?
Well, actually, I do. I have a good friend named Don Lappin who wrote a wonderful book on Alcoholics Anonymous, the founder. It's called Distilled Spirits. And it turns out that the man who invented that 12-step process was reading a scholar of comparative religion named William James, who wrote a book called The Varieties of Religious Experience, in which he discusses the commonalities of mystical experience across the world. So... I think Alcoholics AA and these various 12-step programs are drawing on basic religious principles. But of course, they're not adopting any particular religion. They're kind of a spiritual but not religious movement.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate the example. East of the Rockies, Brenda in Toledo, Ohio. Good morning, Brenda.
Hi, Jeff. Hi, George. I love the thought-provoking show this evening because I come from a very religious background, born and raised. Well, I can't say born and raised, but was a Jehovah's Witness when I was very young, through my teens. Became kind of rebellious and left of my own, free will. They didn't, tie me down to make me stay or anything like that. But over the years, I became restless, looking for a belief again. And I took some theology classes at a, university. And I noticed that when we would talk about the Jehovah's Witness religion, everybody was like, oh, that's called, it's a sect. What they teach isn't true. They don't believe in Jesus. They don't believe in God. But it was just the opposite what I learned as a Jehovah's Witness. They do believe in Jesus. They do believe in God. They are very devout, you know, Bible thumpers. I can't really, I'm not going to say that in a bad derogatory way, but I find myself going back to that religion, and I'm in my 40s. What are your feelings about that belief in a whole? And I'll wait for your answer.
About that, meaning that process of going back to one's birth tradition or one's early tradition? Is that the question, Brenda?
Or why, as a consensus, as a general public, why that religion is thought of as a cult, as a sect, as...
Oh, I know.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Well, first of all, this process of aging and going back to religious community and tradition is a very common process, and it really witnesses to this need that human beings have to have a community and to have a stable tradition, and I think that's just fine. As long as we affirm our humanity over any particular community. Now, in terms of why it's called a cult, I mean, the language of cult is always what religious people use to bash other people's religions. All religions begin as cults, as it were. You know, a cult is a small religious community that is marginalized by the broader society. It's not the consensus reality. But we don't use the language of cult in the study of religion because it's a derogatory term. You know, the Jehovah Witnesses, they're a religious tradition is genuine as any other religious tradition in the eyes of a scholar of comparative religion. But they're suffering from this language of cult because they're still a relatively small community and not part of the consensus in the broader culture.
Thanks, Brenda. Jeff, what's your take on hell? I mean, is visions of hell, threats of hell, more a mechanism of control, a tool to keep people in line for a particular faith, or is it? Do you get input about an existence or reality of hell?
Right. It's a very controversial topic. Personally speaking, I'm not a big fan of hell. I think it's used to hurt people, to scare people, and to control people. I think it's largely a control mechanism. Having said that, I think people do have experiences of hell. I think some near-death experiences are negative near-death experiences, but most aren't. And I think what's happening culturally and historically is hell is dropping away. If you look at near-death experiences in the 13th or 14th century, you're going to see lots of hellish visions and experiences of hell. If you look at modern ND accounts, you do see them, but they're much, much more rare.
I'm guessing you have a lot of end-of-life religious conversions from people who don't really believe in hell, but they figure, well, might as well cover my bases.
Well, I think that's part of it. I think hell also is a moral response that some of us have. You know, we see people doing really bad, unjust, evil things, and we want to imagine that those people will be punished for it. So you sort of need a hell to punish people that are doing bad things. But that, of course, doesn't mean that hell exists. And there's also, of course, hells that are temporary. You know, a lot of religions, particularly in Asia, have hells that we go to, but you're not there forever. You're there just for a little bit until you burn off your bad karma and then you're born again. So, I mean, there are lots of different kinds of hells in the history of religion.
International line, Rob in Vancouver. Good morning, Rob. You're on with Jeffrey Kripal.
Good morning. Honored to speak to you. I'll try to keep, you know, I always feel there's a need for to preference myself before a question, but I'll keep it short. I feel I'm a Catholic, and I grew up going to a Jesuit high school system in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. And it was considered at the time, or at least in the area, to be one of the best school systems to be involved with. And my experience was, you know, throughout that the years of school, we always had to take theology. And theology, that I experienced, was more about studying other religions and looking at different belief systems throughout the world. And it was never, they're wrong, this is, we're right. You know, it was just, you know, looking at different things and they really took the time to break down, you know, the history of the Catholic Church and why things happened and the political things behind it. So I walked away from that with my own choice to be a Christian, but understanding all the noise, you know, that has happened over history. And since then, and learning, I've always had the question of trying to, like, why I can't seem to get people to tie, or how do you tie all these monotheistic religions together? And for a quick example, Vancouver, where I live right now, there's a Krishna festival every year, and so I went to this Krishna festival, and I approached, I don't know the right term, whether it be a priest or perhaps, and I tried to propose this question to you, and I said, look, I'm Catholic, Jesus came down and gave us a message, and I understand there's all this noise to it. Krishna came and gave this message. There's similarities, you know, is there any hope of or is there any connection we can perhaps bring together on a monotheistic level and say, well, maybe this is the same God or the same entity? So I guess the question perhaps is the maybe comment on the challenges, or I'm always perplexed as to why these different monotheistic religions with very common belief aspects can't come together with the idea that they're just one God.
Right. So, Rob, that's a great question. I'm actually a big fan of Catholic higher education. I have a lot of Jesuit friends and was trained by Benedictines myself. And, you know, you were trained by a very sophisticated religious tradition that had come out of Vatican II in the 1960s. And one of the things at Vatican II is a series of church meetings in Rome at the Vatican.
Can I interrupt you for a sec?
What's that?
Can I just interrupt you for a quick second?
Yeah, sure. Hey, Rob, we're going to have to move on here. So just to be fair to other people, go ahead and make your point, and then we're going to let Jeff respond. Rob is gone. Sorry about that. Well, Jeff, if you want to continue.
Basically what Vatican II did is it moved the church, the Catholic Church, from an exclusivistic comparative practice to an inclusivistic one. And by that I mean, before the 1960s, the Catholic Church would have asserted there is no salvation outside the church, and after Vatican II, they asserted that there is. And so the kinds of sophisticated comparative practices that Rob got from the Jesuits really come out of that history. And I discuss all those textbooks, by the way. I mean, Catholicism's a really sophisticated comparative practice.
Kind of jump up to the top of the wild card list. James in New York has been holding for a while. James, what's on your mind? You're on with Jeffrey Kripal.
Oh, good morning, George. Yes, I just wanted to say, I was raised a Catholic, and I came to a few realizations in the last so many years because of my varied paranormal experiences. And anybody I talk to, especially my family, were, you know, rigid religious people, so to speak. And those events that took place, you know, you couldn't interview people because it happened thousands of years ago. And here's their son or brother telling them something that happened today, you know, or this in my lifetime, and they won't believe me. Well, anyway, what I wanted to say was a creator, a supreme creator force wouldn't be human, because everything in our known universe is made up of energy. You know, there's not just humans. You know, we look toward a savior because we have the fear of death, and you know, the ancient aliens are playing on our fears, and you know, because that explained a lot to me. And the supreme creative force would be energy, if anything, and because that's what's in common with plants and animals and the whole world. And it wouldn't reveal itself to one person like Moses or Muhammad, and it wouldn't save a few chosen few people and condemn everybody else, you know?
James, let me just say this before Jeffrey addresses it. In his book, talks about makes a distinction of, like, you, if you think miracles or those kind of strange encounters, burning bush, all happened long, long ago in olden days, That's not true, that this stuff, miracles, whatever you want to call them, happen now, right, Jeffrey?
Yeah, I mean, I completely believe, James, and, you know, people continue to have these paranormal and miraculous experiences. And the reason that the religions reject the modern accounts is that they want to, you know, they want to preserve their revelation or their scriptural texts in the past. They look to the past. The full truth was revealed a long, long time ago. And the problem with modern day paranormal or miraculous events is it's happening today, and it appears to, you know, move the ball forward, as it were. So there's an inherent problem with the paranormal in a lot of religious communities.
Yeah.
Not all.
And I had an event. I mean, I was wanted to kind of talk to the first guest you had on, because I saw a giant UFO just in the last 5 years, where I went to take a picture, and it was after midnight, and the camera was dead, so I didn't recharge it. And it came back the next night, exact same time, exact same part of the sky, and I had a friend with me, and all he could say was, "They're here," and he won't talk about it anymore. It looked like a floating city, you know?
Wow, that would have been a good one to have a photo of. Thank you. Thanks, James. Thanks for that. But, I mean, that's kind of how people are. They see something they can't explain. They don't want to talk about it. I'm not surprised by that.
And James was a perfect example of what I call these comparative practices. He was engaging in a comparative practice that was in conflict with that of his family, who had a very different comparative practice of work.
You know, we've had a couple of these callers, and then you, Jeffrey, talking about Catholic education. I guess, you know, the church does a great job of teaching people how to think. Probably shouldn't be surprised when you do.
Right. And then, you know, Catholicism has moved through a lot of different stages recently, and that's what I was trying to communicate to the earlier caller, that we lost, 100 years ago, the church would have taken a very negative view of other religions, but today not so much.
Listen, we're about out of time here. Jeffrey Kripal, Comparing Religions is the book, and I don't want to overstate it, but man, it's a really good book. It's an important book, and I wish you nothing but success with it.
Well, thanks, George. Thanks for having me on again. I always enjoy these things. I'm willing to lose a bit of sleep to talk to you.
Well, I hope you'll come back. I'm encouraged and intrigued by the project I heard about in the introduction, where you're working on a book about the paranormal in American culture.
Right. Yeah. Well, working on a lot of things. I'd love to come back.
I appreciate it. Thanks very much, and we'll talk to you again.
Okay. Thanks, George. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks to Jeff Kripal, also to Roger Marsh from MUFON, and to my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Nathan Staten, Gina Salvati, Lex Lonehood, and Dan Galante, and Chris Boros, our producer. Thanks, everyone. I'll be back next Sunday. Hope you have a good evening. Good night.